In previous weeks now, we've looked at Jeremiah's famous temple sermon recorded for us in chapters 7 through 9 of his book. Now this morning, I want to turn your attention then to chapter 10 of Jeremiah. And regarding this chapter, Bible scholars are of two opinions. Some believe that chapter 10 actually is a part of that same temple sermon. That is, that the full sermon actually consists of chapters 7 through 10, not just chapters 7 through 9. Others see chapter 10 as an entirely separate sermon, perhaps preached on an entirely different occasion, but one that nonetheless naturally complements the message in chapter 7 through 9. It's a natural follow-up and hence recorded immediately after that temple sermon mount here in the book of Jeremiah. Either way, the end result is the same, that chapter 10 fits nicely after the previous three chapters. So I thought it'd be worthwhile to hear this aspect of Jeremiah's preaching and teaching this morning. We've seen in previous weeks that Jeremiah makes much of the fact that his contemporaries were basically a bunch of liars. They lied about everything. Their entire society and way of life was built on a foundation of lies. Now then, here in chapter 10, he will single out one lie in particular that dominated much of his society. It was a deadly lie that pervaded every aspect of the people's lives. It was the lie of idolatry. Now, in this regard, there were two aspects to this lie, the heavenly aspect and the earthly aspect. We see the heavenly aspect addressed in verse 2. Notice what Jeremiah says in verse 2. Thus saith the Lord, learn not the way of the heathen, and be not dismayed at the signs of heaven, for the heathen are dismayed at them. He speaks here of not being dismayed at the signs of heaven. The word translated as dismayed means literally to be terrorized, to be frightened, scared to death. He says, you know, the heathen, when they look at the heavens, they see things that literally terrorize them. They are frightened by this stuff. And he says, you don't need to be frightened like that. They were frightened of the heavens, first of all, because heavenly events such as comets or eclipses were seen by them as bad omens, portents of bad things to come. And secondly, the heavenly bodies were believed in some way or other to have mysterious powers that controlled the events and affairs of their lives. These were people who believed in the myth of astrology and the zodiac. Of course, even to this day, people are into that kind of thing. They'll often ask you, hey, what sign are you? Are you a Sagittarius or an Aries? And some are just kind of taking it lightly, just kidding about that. But others take that quite seriously. And so it was in the days of Jeremiah. Indeed, so powerful were these heavenly bodies that divinity was often attributed to them. The sun and the moon thus became gods that exercised control over their lives. And they were frightened, terrorized by these things because they felt, therefore, that they were the victims of mysterious forces and powers out there in the universe that they could not control. And this fear drove them, to whatever extent possible, to seek ways in which they could harness that power and at least exert some degree of control over their lives and the events that therefore unfolded. They were driven by fear to seek to curry favor with the gods, that these gods might bless them or reward them. And this therefore leads to the second aspect of this lie of idolatry, the earthly aspect. What they were doing here on earth to try to gain some sense of control and manage their own lives. And it was the idolatry proper. Notice, for example, what he goes on to say in verses 3 through 4. Verses 3 through 4. For the customs of the people are vain. For one cutteth a tree out of the forest, the work of the hands of the workmen, with the axe. They deck it with silver and with gold. They fashion it with nails and with hammers, that it move not. And likewise, jump down to verse 9. Verse 9, he says, silver spread into plates is brought from Tarshish, and gold from Uphaz, the work of the workmen and of the hands of the founder. Blue and purple is their clothing. They are all the work of cunning men. You see, they were here making idols, and these idols that they were making were not viewed merely as visual or artistic representations of the gods. No, in some kind of mysterious way that they could not fully explain, nonetheless, they believed that by some kind of sympathetic magic. There was a real connection between the idol and the god. In some cases, perhaps even the spirit of the god resided within the idol. And so they invested a lot of time and effort into the making of these idols, and these people weren't playing around with this. They would hire the best of craftsmen to carve the wood into a shape. They would hire top goldsmiths and silversmiths to overlay them with all manner of precious metals, perhaps even to forge the whole thing from precious metals. And this was the best and most refined silver and gold that money could buy. And moreover, they clothed these man-made idols in blue and purple. Those were the colors of royalty. They were the most expensive and lavish type of clothing in the ancient world. Nothing more expensive than blue and purple garments. Only the rich, only royalty could afford that. But this is what they were clothing those idols in. So you see, these people weren't playing around. In summary, it was all about power and money. The power that resided in the heavens and the money they spent here on earth trying to harness that power and exert some degree of control. This was the orthodoxy of their day, and none dare question it, not without fear of losing his own life. You'll recall we saw from a previous message that they threatened Jeremiah's life. They wanted him dead. In fact, even his own relatives, his own family members, had hatched an assassination plot against him. And Jeremiah was saved only by the mercy and the divine intervention of God. But one didn't have to be a prophet. You didn't have to be a saved person. Simply question the status quo and your life would be in danger. Because these people weren't playing around with this. They were deadly serious about it. This is illustrated in the broader cultures of the day, not just the Jewish people, but he mentions the heathen. Don't learn the ways of the heathen. I mean, all of the peoples were doing this. The surrounding nations, the Egyptians, the Babylonians, the Syrians to the north, the Greeks. Some 200 years after the time of Jeremiah in the land of Greece, Socrates learned that lesson. Early in his life as a young man, he engaged in what they called natural philosophy. You know, Socrates was a great philosopher, but he was engaged in natural philosophy, which is basically a way of saying that he was trying to learn and develop science. You know, it would ultimately become the idea of science. And there were others who had gone before him who had tried to do that, practicing science in terms of trying to understand what is it that really makes the physical world and the universe operate? What are those laws and principles that govern the universe? Things like the law of gravity and so forth that you could learn, you could understand, and you could predict. But those are questions one should not be asking. And Socrates realized the danger of that. And so at an early point in his life, he switched away from asking those kinds of questions. What is it that makes the world go around? Because that's a dangerous thing. He thought it was safer instead to devote the rest of his life to more moral and ethical philosophy. That is, he was decided instead, let's ask questions like, what is justice? What is the best political system? An oligarchy or a democracy or a timocracy? And, what makes the best king? And, of course, he would argue a philosopher king. And those were safe questions. You could ask those questions. Nobody cared if you asked a question like, what is justice? Nobody cared if you raised the question, what's the best political system, democracy or oligarchy or something like that? But you dare not think that you can know and understand physical laws that govern the universe. But even though he steered away from his youth, he could never truly escape his past. There was a famous playwright in his time, Aristophanes, who wrote what he considered, in fact, his best play. It was a play in which he spoofed Socrates. He made fun of him. He mocked him. There's a scene in the play where it portrays him being in his laboratory there at home, and Socrates is doing an experiment with fleas to see how far a flea can jump. And see, this is spoofing Socrates because it's saying Socrates is looking down instead of lifting his eyes up and looking to the heavens, all the mysterious powers that are there, and the gods, it's the gods who determine our fates. It's the gods who make the world go round according to their choices and decisions, and we cannot predict what the gods will do. So this idea that you can study and learn unchanging and fixed laws and principles that govern the world, no. Socrates, stop looking down at tiny, insignificant things like fleas, the things of the world, and instead lift your eyes to the heavens and worship the gods. In this play, Socrates is even portrayed as saying, I doubt that Zeus even exists. And so it was, though he tried to escape, his dabbling in science of the past, he couldn't do it. If you know your history, you know that Socrates was eventually brought to court there in Athens. They tried him, and he was found guilty of a capital crime. They sentenced him to death. His crime? Atheism. He challenged the existence of the gods of Athens. Now, whether he was an atheist proper, that is, that he didn't believe in any kind of god, or whether he simply didn't believe in the gods of Athens is not clear. I'm not an expert, on philosophy and Socrates. Of course, that's not my field. But from what I've seen of his writings, he actually seemed to be open to the idea of a god. He talked about the one god. He wasn't buying this nonsense of all these multiple gods, the gods of Athens, who seemed to be nothing more than glorified human beings with all the same foibles and so forth. But he was open to the idea that there would be one creator god above and over all. But this the Athenians could not tolerate. You must believe in the gods out here. And because he did not, he was sentenced to death. Later, Aristotle would find himself also fleeing Athens for the same reason, lest he meet the same fate. These men, of course, were pagans. They weren't Christians. They weren't believers in the Lord and in the gospel, but they questioned the orthodoxy of their day, and that's all it took. Now, if all this seems rather arcane and irrelevant to us, the sophisticated day and age in which we live, think again. How often do you hear people thanking their lucky stars? And for some, that's just an expression, but for many, it's not. You literally will hear people today praying to the universe. Not God, the universe. Or thanking the universe. If you're listening, you'll hear it. And these people are serious. A few years ago, there was an article written by a professor at Notre Dame University. It was an opinion article that was published in the New York Times. I want you to notice what this professor from Notre Dame wrote in the New York Times. Quote, shouldn't we hold a merely agnostic position on Zeus and the other Greek gods, taking seriously the possibility that they existed? He goes on to write, I'm inclined to say that an atheistic denial of Zeus is ungrounded. There is no current evidence of his present existence, but to deny that he existed in his Grecian heyday, well, we need to assume that there was no good evidence for his existence available to the ancient Greeks. And we have no reason to make this assumption. Furthermore, supposing that Zeus did exist in ancient times, do we really have evidence that he has ceased to exist? He may, for all we know, just be in hiding now that other gods have won humankind's allegiance. Or it may be that we've just lost the ability to perceive the divine. In any case, to the question, may we properly remain agnostic about whether Zeus ever existed? The answer is yes, we may. So if you think that this idea is, that's ancient history, it's not. We have people today saying, how do you know? Maybe Zeus did exist. Maybe he still does. Of course, the orthodoxies of our day, none of which can be questioned, aren't limited directly to theological issues, right? Simply today suggests that gender is binary. You have two genders, male and female. And see how well that goes over in today's society, right? Question the orthodoxy of the day. Question whether global warming, accepting the premise that maybe within a certain moderate range, the planet has warmed up a bit, question whether that is due to man-made causes as perhaps, a natural explanation like, the sun. It cycles through at certain times. You get, puts out a little more heat within a certain range. Simply question the idea that global warming is man-made. And what response do you get? But you see, this is what societies and cultures do. They create a story, a narrative, and you dare not question it. And for the people of Jeremiah's day, it was a narrative of idolatry. But what an incredibly shaky foundation upon which to build a society. It was all a lie. There was nothing to it at all. Notice how time and again Jeremiah stresses that. For example, look at the first part of verse 3 again. First part of verse 3, he says, "For the customs of the people are vain." It's vain. The word there means it's empty, it's hollow, there's no substance, there's nothing to this stuff. Likewise, look at verse 5. Speaking of the idols that they create, he says in verse 5, "They are upright as the palm tree, but speak not. They must needs be born, because they cannot go. Be not afraid of them, for they cannot do evil, neither also is it in them to do good." You don't need to be afraid of these idols. They can't talk, they can't walk, they can't go anywhere. First part of verse 5, he says they're upright as a palm tree. The Hebrew expression there could also be translated another way, which I think probably is the appropriate translation in this context. I wanted to get into the complexities of the Hebrew, but just to suggest the other translation, it could also be translated as they are like scarecrows in a cucumber field. And I think that's really what he's saying. That's the image. It's nothing more than a scarecrow out there. You know, scarecrows, they can't talk. And as we all learn from the Wizard of Oz, they don't have brains. Right? And yet these people were terrified of these idols. Or look at verse 8. Verse 8. Again, speaking of the idolatry, he says, "But they are altogether brutish and foolish. The stock is a doctrine of vanities." He says, these idols and the people that worship them. He says, they're all together, all of them. All of the heathen and the whole thing is what he's saying. The whole thing, every single one of these false gods, every one of these idols and all the people, it's just brutish. That's in modern English, you might say stupid. On the level of a dumb animal, just a brute. And foolish. It's stupid. It's foolish. It's just nonsense. The latter part of the verse 8 there, it says the stock is a doctrine of vanities. Again, you back to that, this stuff is just hollow and it's empty. And the word stock means just a tree, a chunk of wood. Literally, the Hebrew reads a little more forcefully. It basically, Jeremiah just saying, it's a tree, people. It's just a piece of wood. And then verses 14 through 15, He says, "Every man is brutish in his knowledge. Every founder is confounded by the graven image. For his molten image is falsehood, and there is no breath in them. They are vanity and the work of errors. In the time of their visitation, they shall perish." Again, verse 14 is just stupid. Their own images make fools of them. They're making fools of themselves with their idols. For again, he says in verse 15, "They are vanity, hollow, empty, nothing to them. They are the work of errors." So the idols are stupid, and so are the people who worship them. And this extended even to the leaders of the nation. For notice what he says in verse 21. Verse 21, "For the pastors are become brutish and have not sought the Lord. Therefore they shall not prosper, and all their flocks shall be scattered." The pastors are the leaders of the nation, but they too were caught up in it all. They too were stupid and foolish. And so it was all just a lie. But the problem, of course, is when you build your life on lies, the sure result is fear. That's why in verse 2, he speaks of the people being dismayed at the heavens. They're terrorized by this stuff. Likewise, in verse 5, Jeremiah says, don't be afraid of these idols the way that the heathen are. You see, whether it's the heavens or the idols that they're worshiping, the result was always the same. There's fear. Now, by way of application, you may not be involved in idol worship, but still, the world can be a scary place. If you see yourself as the victim of circumstances beyond your control, you feel at times your life spins out of control and you don't like that. You look at the events that transpire in your life and lacking control, you respond in fear. It is because you are not living a truth-based life, but rather you are basing your life on a lie. You are living out a lie rather than responding to the truth. The lie always produces fear. Now hold your place here in Jeremiah chapter 10, and in this regard, let me remind you what Jesus says in Matthew chapter 6. In his famous Sermon on the Mount, Jesus again will tell us, don't be like the heathen. And build your life on the same lies they do, which only leads to fear. And so Matthew chapter 6, notice how he says it, verse 25 and following. Therefore I say unto you, take no thought for your life, what ye shall eat or what ye shall drink, nor yet for your body, what ye shall put on. Is not the life more than meat, and the body than raiment? Behold the fowls of the air, for they sow not, neither do they reap, nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feedeth them. Are ye not much better than they? And which of you, by taking thought, can add one cubit unto his stature? And why take ye thought for raiment? Consider the lilies of the field, how they grow. They toil not, neither do they spin. And yet I say unto you that even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. Wherefore, if God so clothe the grass of the field, which today is and tomorrow is cast into the oven, shall he not much more clothe you, O ye of little faith? Therefore take no thought, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or wherewithal shall we be clothed? For after all these things do the Gentiles seek. For your heavenly Father knoweth that ye have need of all these things. But seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added unto you. Take therefore no thought for the morrow shall take thought for the things of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. Jesus says, listen, don't worry about this stuff. Don't stress about this stuff. You got to control and manage all of this stuff. That's what the Gentiles do. This is what the heathen do. Don't be like them. Don't be afraid like them. Don't be afraid of forces and circumstances that are out of your control, and therefore you clutch and grasp trying to gain control. But when we do so, it is simply a symptom that we're not living out the truth, but basing our life and decisions on a lie. So what really is the truth on which we must base our life? What does it mean to live a truth-based life? What is the truth? Well, turn your attention back to Jeremiah chapter 10 and verse 10. Jeremiah says, here's the truth at the bottom of it all. Chapter 10, the first part of verse 10. He says, but the Lord is the true God. He is the living God and an everlasting King. The Lord is the true God, Jehovah God. That's the truth. And what do we know about this true God? Well, here Jeremiah gives us a brief theology lesson. In quick fashion, he runs through a lot of things that actually you can know about the true God. The first thing he tells us here about him is, unlike the idols, he is a living God. There in verse 10, he explicitly says, he is the living God. These idols, no, they don't walk, they don't talk, they don't breathe. There's no life, there's no breath in them, nothing. It's just a chunk of wood. But the real God is alive. He is a living being. Furthermore, he is everlasting, he says there in verse 10, that he is this everlasting King. Moses tells us in Psalm 92 that before the mountains were brought forth, or ever thou hadst formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. He is eternal, meaning he transcends therefore all of time and space. He's not limited or in any way restricted by such things. He is not contingent on anything for his existence. He doesn't need anything else for himself to exist. Indeed, is not this the very meaning of his name, Jehovah? I am? As he told Moses, I am that I am. Period. I simply am. I exist without reference to anything else. And I don't need anything else. This is what the name Jehovah means. It means I am. And is not this the all-important truth that our Savior, Jesus Christ, proclaimed about himself? When, for example, he said in John 8:58, before Abraham was, I am. And when he further said there in John chapter 8, verse 24, if you believe not that I am, ye shall die in your sins. See, Those of us who are saved because we put our faith or confidence in the person and the work of Jesus Christ. And what is our faith? Our faith is that Jesus of Nazareth is the great I Am, the eternally self-existent one who needs nobody and nothing for his existence. And if you don't believe that's who he is, if you believe he's anything less than that, then you've put your faith in the wrong place. But it is precisely because he is the everlasting one that his salvation has everlasting value. Moving on, we are also told by Jeremiah that he is a very powerful God. Look what Jeremiah said in verse 6. He says, "For as much as there is none like unto thee, O Lord, thou art great, and thy name is great in might." He's a great God indeed, a powerful God, a mighty God. He is great in his might. We know so much so that, in fact, he is all-powerful. Other scriptures proclaim that. No limit to his power. And not only is he powerful, he's also wise. We get this in verse 7, the next verse. Notice what he says in verse 7. "Who would not fear thee, O King of nations? For to thee doth it appertain. For as much as among all the wise men of the nations and in all their kingdoms, there is none like unto thee." Nobody as wise as God. None of us even comes close. Nobody in the entire world. And therefore, he is the King of all nations. To him, that title rightly applies. Not just the King of the Jews, not just the God of the Jews. No, he's the God of all the world. It is a title that rightly belongs to him because he is all wise. And so, there's no need to fear the forces of this world. There's only one thing to fear, as he says in verse 7, and that is the Lord himself, the King of nations. You don't need to fear forces and events and circumstances beyond your control. Only one thing you need to fear, and that is the Lord himself. Although here, when he speaks of fearing the Lord, this is a different word that Jeremiah uses than when he spoke of fearing the heavens and fearing the idols. When he spoke of fearing the heavens and idols, that's a word that just literally means nothing but fright and fear and terror. But the term fearing the Lord and the fear of the Lord is a broader term. It would encompass, yes, a healthy fear of God. I mean, who would not come into the presence of an all-powerful being and not have a little sense of fear? There's a place for healthy fear. But it's much more than just fear and fright. In a nutshell, in summary, the fear of the Lord, this fear that is spoken of here, is basically means that all of your life is lived with reference to God. He is the center point. Everything is seen through the lens of God, and he is the centerpiece of one's life. This is what it means, the fear of the Lord. And so rather than being terrorized by omens in the sky, instead, what you should do is make God the centerpiece of your life. And these two concepts that we've spoken here, power and wisdom, they go together. Because think of this, if God indeed were so powerful, but yet he lacked wisdom, then he wouldn't always use his power in wise ways. Right? That'd be kind of a scary God, wouldn't it? He's got all this power, but he doesn't have good sense to use it in proper ways. Or vice versa. Suppose that he were all wise and omniscient. He knew all things, but alas, he weren't all powerful. So he wouldn't therefore have the power always to do the things that he knew were the wise things to do. He might want to do them, but alas, he would lack the power. You know, and sometimes people often see God in such ways. Why, you know, I've got a free will and I can freely make my choices, and, you know, God's power is limited by, you know, the choices I'm going to make. Or they might say even his wisdom. God doesn't really know the future because, you know, everything's contingent on what choices I might make. But God is all powerful and he is all wise, your free will notwithstanding. He is not limited by the choices you make. He is both powerful and wise. Now hold your place here and let me remind you what Isaiah says on this same topic in a similar vein, how he so characterizes the one true God. Isaiah chapter 40. Look, for example, here in Isaiah 40, what he says about God in verses 12 through 15. That's Isaiah 40, verses 12 through 15. Isaiah 40, 12 through 15. Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand, and meted out heaven with the span, and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, and weighed the mountains in scales, and the hills in a balance? Who hath directed the Spirit of the Lord, or being his counselor, hath taught him? With whom took he counsel, and who instructed him, and taught him in the path of judgment, and taught him knowledge, and showed to him the way of understanding? Behold, the nations are as a drop of a bucket, nor counted as the small dust of the balance. Behold, he taketh up the isles as a very little thing. And jump down to verses 21 through 23. Continuing on here, Isaiah says in verse 21 through 23, have ye not known? Have ye not heard? Hath it not been told you from the beginning? Have ye not understood from the foundations of the earth? It is he that sitteth upon the circle, or that is the sphere of the earth, and the inhabitants thereof are as grasshoppers, that stretcheth out the heavens as a curtain, and spreadeth them out as a tent to dwell in, that bringeth the princes to nothing. He maketh the judges of the earth as vanity. And jump down to verses 25 through 26, verse 25 through 26. To whom then will ye liken me, or shall I be equal, saith the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and behold, who hath created these things that bringeth out their hosts by number? He calleth them all by names, by the greatness of his might, for that he is strong in power, not one faileth. See, Isaiah says, don't look to the heavens and fear them, but rather look to the one who created the heavens. See, who put them all out there, spread them out, and he knows the name of every single one. Think of this. There are billions and billions and billions and billions and billions of stars in our galaxy, and he hasn't lost track of one of them. In fact, he has a name for every one of them. And then verse 28, in verse 28, hast thou not known, hast thou not heard that the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, fainteth not, neither is weary, and there is no searching of his understanding? You see, he is all-powerful and all-wise. Turning your attention back to Jeremiah chapter 10, as Isaiah has anticipated, likewise Jeremiah then comes to this point that he is the creator of all things. Notice what Jeremiah says in chapter 10, verses 11 through 12. Verses 11 through 10. Thus shall ye say unto them, the gods that have not made the heavens and the earth, even they shall perish from the earth and from under these heavens. He hath made the earth by his power. He hath established the world by his wisdom, and hath stretched out the heavens by his discretion. And jump down to verse 16. In verse 16 he says, the portion of Jacob is not like them, for he is the former of all things. See, who made the heavens and the earth? The one true God, Jehovah. Who formed all things that have ever been made and formed? Jehovah God. In verse 12, he tells us it is by his power that he created the world, and by his wisdom that he created the world. That power and wisdom, the means by which he creates. By contrast, he says in verse 11, the gods have created nothing. The gods that have not made the heavens and the earth, they'll go away someday. They're going to disappear, and the people that worship them, the idols and all such concepts of idolatry, will disappear. And this, by the way, is a message that Jeremiah addresses not only to his fellow Jews, but to all the world. In verse 11, he is speaking to all the world. He wants the heathen. He wants all the Gentiles. He wants all the pagans to get this message too. That all these gods that you fear and that you worship, they did not make the heavens and the earth, and they are going away, while the one true God, Jehovah, lasts forever. We know that Jeremiah wants this statement in verse 11 to be heard by all the world for a couple reasons. First of all, because suddenly, when you get to verse 11, Jeremiah switches. As you know, the Jewish people normally spoke and wrote in Hebrew, and so most of the Old Testament is written in Hebrew, and so Jeremiah is speaking in Hebrew. Until you get to verse 11, all of a sudden, boom, he switches to the Aramaic language. He switches languages. Just that one verse, this verse 11. In fact, to be honest, I kind of forgot. I knew that there was this one verse in Jeremiah that was in Aramaic, but I'd kind of forgotten that. And this week when I was studying the message, they're reading along, and wait, what? why did Jeremiah just all of a sudden throw in an Aramaic word? And then I read the next word, and I said, well, that's Aramaic too. And I looked at the whole verse is in Aramaic. And then I remembered, oh, that's right. Yeah, there was that one verse. I knew that. And I, why does he suddenly switch, though? I knew that there was this one verse that was written in Hebrew, but he switched languages. And I said, well, why does he do that? The reason he did that is not many people knew Hebrew. Only Jews spoke Hebrew. But Aramaic was the lingua franca of the day. It was what English is today. Everybody around the world knows English. So let's say if you're a Russian person, you want to get a message out to the world. If you convey that message in Russian, how many people are going to get your message, right? Yet, not many of us. But if you wanted to get out to the world, you're going to put it in English, right? That's going to give you the biggest audience. And so Jeremiah is mostly speaking to his contemporaries, and so he's speaking in Hebrew. But then that message in verse 11, he wants to get out to the whole world, so he switches to the one language that everybody in the world knew in his day and time. It was the international language of trade and diplomacy, Aramaic. I want the whole world to hear this. And not only so, he tries to make the statement memorable. A nice, pithy statement. So he casts it in the form of poetry, a neat little poetic device. So thou'll understand it and thou'll remember it. Because I want you to hear this and I want you to remember it. So here's how it actually kind of structured. You can kind of see this looking in the English translation. But if you look at the Aramaic, it's a little more clear. He begins by talking about those gods with a little g. And he will end by referring back to those gods. The second thing that he references here in this verse is the heavens. They didn't make the heavens. And the second to the last thing that he references is the word heavens. The third thing he mentions is the earth. Likewise, the third to the last thing he mentions is the earth. And then smack dab in the middle of the verse, the bullseye of the target, we have these two verbs that they haven't, what's true of the gods. They didn't make this stuff, and they're going to perish. Now, in English, those two words, they don't seem parallel. They're not in terms of meaning, but in the Aramaic language, they are parallel in how they sound. I've given you a transliteration of them, but then you can see how similarly they're spelled. And they sound very similar. One word would be pronounced as Yavad, and the other would be pronounced as Avad. See how similar they are? They sound almost the same, don't they? And so those are the parallels. So you see, the whole passage has this neat little structure. That's a device of poetry in the ancient world that makes the statement very memorable. And so these gods who didn't create the heavens and the earth are correspondingly going to perish from the heavens and the earth that they didn't make. And so Jeremiah here isn't just talking to the Jewish people. He is sending a message to the whole world. Your gods didn't make this world. And your gods are going away. So if you're building your life on the lie of idolatry, you might want to think again. It's taken you nowhere. There is only one creator, and he will not share his glory with another. But it's not true that only that he created all things. Having created all things, he now exercises control over them. You see, the God of Scripture is not the God of the deists. In deism, they believe that there is a creator God, a God who created everything and set everything in motion. But he set everything up only to run by natural laws that now govern and run. So now he just steps back and he's passive and he lets the world run. And he lets people run and do the things that they will do. But this is not the God of Scripture. He didn't only create the world like a clockmaker making a clock and winding it up and then letting it run. Having created it, he runs it. He's actively involved in this creation every single day. If he were not, as Paul will tell us in Colossians, everything would just vanish away. Everything runs contingent on God. He didn't just make it. He runs it. He controls it all. Now, in this regard, then, we saw in verse 10 that he's called the everlasting king. He's called a king because he is sovereign. He rules and he reigns over all that he's created. In this regard, then, we see that he, for example, exerts control over the physical creation. Notice what he says, for example, in verse 13 here. In verse 13, when he uttereth his voice, there is a multitude of waters in the heavens, and he causeth the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He maketh lightnings with rain and bringeth forth the wind out of his treasuries. Now see, Jeremiah's contemporaries believed that the god Baal was the one who made it rain. That rain came by the power of Baal sent from heaven. And Jeremiah says, no, it's not Baal who causes rain and lightning and thunder. All that comes from Jehovah God. And the way he does this is he causes small drops of water to rise up into the air and form clouds. And then when he's ready, he has those clouds drop that water back down to the earth again. So he's just, of course, described here the water cycle. We can describe it and characterize it in scientific terms. The water goes up there, comes over, you know, and then it comes over dry land, and it drops, and then it goes back up and repeats. But this isn't just a physical law operating. There's a God behind that. He's the one who's actually causing that to happen. It's not Baal. It's not abstract laws. It's God. Not only does he control all of physical creation, he controls also all of people. For notice again how he's characterized in the first part of verse 7. In verse 7, Jeremiah says, who would not fear thee, O King of nations? He's the King of nations and peoples. Not just the physical creation, but the nations and the peoples of the world. He controls them too. As Daniel will say, God raises up kings and he takes down kings. Moving on, we also learn from Jeremiah in this chapter that he is a relational God. He is a social God who enjoys entering into relationships with others. And so notice, for example, what he says in verse 16. Verse 16, the portion of Jacob is not like them, meaning not like the idols. For he is the former of all things, and Israel is the rod of his inheritance. The Lord of hosts is his name. You observe here the reciprocal relationship that is exhibited. You see, God is Israel's portion, he says. And vice versa, Israel is God's inheritance. He is their God, they are his people. And they have a relationship with one another, a relationship that has been sealed by a covenant he made with them at Mount Sinai. God is a covenant-making God. He enters into relationships with people. Not just relationships of convenience. God's not a user. He doesn't use people and then move on. God makes relationships, enters into relationships with people where he commits. He locks in. And when God enters into a relationship with you, it is a forever relationship. He'll never walk away from you. He'll never walk out of that relationship. He'll never drop you when it becomes inconvenient. And so he seals the deal with a covenant. You see, he's a relational God. And he offers to enter into a personal relationship with all people through the new covenant. Well, he had a covenant with the Jewish people that was made at Mount Sinai. In the new covenant, God offers anybody, whosoever will, may come and enter into a relationship with me, he says. What a difference from the gods worshipped by the pagans. I remember some years ago reading the story about a lady who had immersed herself in the New Age movement, New Age philosophy. She was, you know, at first she, you know, she was impressed with it, and, you know, the knowledge that she had gained by studying so much New Age philosophy and techniques and how to tap into the power of crystals. And that was kind of a neat thing, the power. I've learned how to harness and somewhat can work with or utilize the forces and the powers of the universe. And so initially it was kind of neat that where she thought she was learning new things and getting power that could help her control her life. But after a while, her involvement in the New Age movement left her empty. Because she realized it was all so impersonal. At the end of the day, it was all about nothing but forces and powers that you try to manipulate. That's it. Just forces and powers. Well, how does one have a relationship with a force? How does one have a relationship with a power? How do you have a relationship with a crystal? What does a crystal do for your heart? It's, as Jeremiah might say, it's just a rock, people. You can't have a relationship with a rock. And I don't remember the details of the story, how it is that she came across the Bible, but she came across the Bible, and she's down at the beginning in Genesis and started reading through the Bible. And in the Bible, she encountered a God who was so different than anything she had ever encountered in the New Age movement. From the very beginning, here was a living, personal being who delighted entering into relationship with people. From the very beginning, he creates Adam and Eve to have relationship with one another and then enter into fellowship relationship with him. Every evening, he would come down into the garden in the cool of the day and walk and talk with Adam and Eve. And when they fell into sin and brought the earth into a curse, immediately he goes to work to work out a plan whereby he could restore the broken relationship. As she continues to read, she finds a God who, as I said, begins entering into covenants with people like Abraham and the Jewish people. He locks into relationships with them. She gets to the New Testament. Here's Jesus Christ inviting people to come into a relationship with him. And she got saved. And she found in Christ what she never had in the New Age movement, a personal relationship with the true God. You see, the heathen didn't have that. Nobody had a personal relationship with Baal. Nobody had a personal relationship with Zeus. The best you could hope for was to curry favor with the gods and hope they might reward you. But you didn't have a relationship with them. You see, the true God is a relational God who wants a relationship with you. Moving on, Jeremiah tells us that he is a just God. Notice what he says in verse 25. Verse 25. Pour out thy fury upon the heathen that know thee not, and upon the families that call not on thy name. You see, a just God does judge and punish sin. He does justice. And Jeremiah says, for those who will not acknowledge the true God. They refuse the truth. They insist on embracing the lie of idolatry. They won't call on you. They know there's one true creator God who made all of this. But they don't want the truth. They want a lie. They will not call on your name. Well, then, for those who want a lie, they'll need to face justice. And God does justice. He is a just and a holy God. And a just penalty will be meted out to those who prefer lies over truth. But he's not only a just God, he's also a merciful God. Jeremiah knows this, and it comes out then in his in the wording of verses 23 through 24. But notice what Jeremiah says here in verses 23 through 24. O Lord, I know that the way of man is not in himself. It is not in man that walketh to direct his steps. O Lord, correct me, but with judgment, not in thine anger, lest thou bring me to nothing. You see, in verse 23, Jeremiah acknowledges that we often stray from the right path. You know, human, we don't have it within ourselves to direct our own steps. We are going to stray often from the straight and the narrow. But when we do so, it is not because we've chosen the lie. It's simply because we're fallen and broken beings. It's because we are weak. And for those of us who welcome the truth, who want God to correct our paths, but he is a merciful God who will do that. And so in verse 24, this is why Jeremiah with confidence prays upon the Lord to correct me. You see, when I've gone down the wrong path, when I stray from the truth, Lord, I want you to correct me because I want the truth. I want to be living a truth-based life. As soon as I start straying from the truth, God, you correct me. Not in your anger. See, in verse 25, God's anger, this is his justice and his holiness. His anger, his wrath, is poured out toward those who don't want truth. But Jeremiah says, God, I want truth, so I want you to correct me, but not in anger, but in judgment. What is judgment? Judgment is the wise application of the law. What does a wise judge do? Does he always apply the maximum penalty of the law in every case, in every circumstance, regardless of who committed the crime and why and what were the circumstances? Well, no, a wise application of the law always tempers justice with mercy. Jeremiah doesn't want pure justice. He wants a God who tempers justice with mercy. And so it is. A wise application of the law. In our case, Christ accomplished this by satisfying the demands of the law at Calvary and taking that wrath and anger of a holy and just God upon himself. And in an act of mercy, God accepts that substitute in our place. And thus he is both just and the justifier of those who believe and welcome the truth in their lives. Jeremiah knew the true God is a God of mercy. That mercy is found in his Son, Jesus Christ. So in conclusion, and what we've seen this morning from Jeremiah chapter 10, there is only one true God. And what we know of him is that he lives, he is everlasting, he is powerful, he is wise, he is the creator of all things and the controller of all things. He is a relational God, he is just, and he is merciful. So then, what do you do with this truth? What you do is you put your trust and confidence in this God. You build your life on this truth. You act in all circumstances of life on that truth, not in fear. But when you build your life on the lie, on things that simply aren't true, it results in fear. And that's what causes you to clutch and grasp, or grasping for control. I've got to take care of this. You know, what am I going to be clothed? What am I going to eat tomorrow? And you start worrying and you clutch and you grasp and you try to control your own circumstances, a life that you feel is spinning out of control, and you try to grab as much control as you can. See, that's coming from the fear. That's coming from acting on a lie. When you build your life on the truth, you simply rest and trust in God. That results in peace. A peace that passes all understanding. Easier said than done. But we all need to be reminded of the truth and be challenged as much as possible to live out the truth rather than basing our life and choices on lies.